We come to the third presentation in our main 2012 series. We began with four presentations that made a kind of a square of attention as a précis for the year, and entitled that Our Old Aeon, meaning a 2,000-year time form. And it was 2,000 years ago that the Greek term aeon came into very prominent usage. You hardly ever found that before. The time form that was very stressed as a popular way of computing long centuries was the cycle of the phoenix, 500 years, and that came in about 500 BC. We, of course, in the 21st century, are hardly aware that the use of time forms is important as an index to ourselves, especially in relationship not just to the universe, but to the cosmos. One of the great popular magazines on astronomy from England, Astronomy, has the future of space exploration. It has the rock star from Queen, Brian May, giving a précis, an appreciation of the first 50 years of humans in space. There is a great magazine of solar system studies, Icarus, now in its 217th volume. It began in the 1960s, and one of the founders of it, Carl Sagan from Cornell at the time. This particular issue has an illustration from Botticelli's Birth of Venus, because the entire issue is about Venus. So much material has been collected that in one single month we can have almost 450 pages on Venus. And this publication comes out every single month, so that we have about 6,000 pages per year just from one journal covering the solar system. Nature, of course, out of England as well. Now, and I guess it must be about 120, 130 years, and the latest issue is Other Worlds, that we have, in fact, come so far that the latest Science Daily has an article that there may be 100,000 bodies the size of Pluto or larger at the edge of our star system in the Kuiper Belt. So we are in a great era of exploration, and by 2016 we will have drawn a very large diagonal through our star system for the first time and encounter the energies of interstellar cosmic proportions, so that by 2012 we're getting very close to a major threshold, and we're trying to appreciate that this threshold condenses and compacts, it compresses the dimensions of space-time. The most salient dimension that is compressed is time. And time as an energy is a good candidate for dark energy, which constitutes a great proportion, the major part, of what is real. If time is dark energy, then space is dark matter. And that when we're talking about a compression of time, it means that this threshold that we're coming up to by 2016 involves a compression by other dimensions. What other dimensions are there than the four dimensions of space-time that we have inquired for quite some long while now, for me, more than 40 years on the professorial level? Immediately, the fifth dimension is that of differential consciousness, which occupies a dimensional energy independent of time. And because consciousness is independent of time, it is also not dependent upon space, which means that phenomenality, matter that condenses out of the dark matter of space, is in a position when it juxtaposes with the fifth dimension of consciousness, it becomes capable of transformation. And the energy that transforms it is not an energy from space-time, but is affine in a symmetry with the source of space-time. And the source of space-time, for those who have done or are doing the learning civilization, that comes out of nature, and that nature is a field, in particular a zero field, especially a fertile zero field, which becomes a mystery immediately. When I was about 11 years old, I bought this copy of The Nature of the Universe by Fred Hoyle, a very popular astronomer at the time. He eventually wrote a couple of science fiction novels, but he was a jovial egghead. And in the early 1950s, this was about as far as one could go. It has about 128 pages. It's The Nature of the Universe. And in it, for the first time, one found a photograph looking down upon the Earth from a camera that was poised on a very interesting rocket called the WAC, the WAC Corporal, and it had been set into a captured V-2 from World War II. And about this time of the year, in 1949, that two-stage rocket took this camera 250 miles above the Earth, higher than the International Space Station. The program was run under a secret government program called the MX-775. And because I started out in electrical engineering, my first college paper was on the MX-775 program. It's interesting to see that we could have been in space by 1950. What has happened is that the compression of space-time includes, in an exacerbated way, the compression of civilization. That while nature itself, as a field, does not show a compression, the compressibility of matter, of materiality, is noticeable. But when it comes to our sense of civilization, because we are in a braid of three different time forms, two that overlap and a third that speckles between the two, one a time form of anchoring reference, and about 350 years later, a carrier of the import of what that reference is developing and speckled in around them are pilot waves of men and women who are sensitive to the motions of these different times, of the three kinds of times, and that when you keep track of three kinds of times at once, one begins to develop the ability to see through what is physically, sensually there, and what is mentally discernible about the meaning of what is there, into the field of vision, into the field of differential consciousness. So 2,000 years ago, when this was becoming evident in a very huge way, and time was being compressed by the consciousness then, about, I usually style it as 0 BC, because it's easy then to realize that one could penetrate back to the original nature. And when one did, one came out with this kind of writing. Read just a few sentences. This was written in Alexandria about the early 90s AD. Since the craftsman made the whole cosmos by reasoned speech, not by hand, you should conceive of him as present, as always existing, as having made all things, as the one and only, and as having crafted by his own will the things that are. For this is his body, neither tangible, nor visible, nor measurable, nor dimensionable. Like any other body, it is not fire, nor water, nor air, nor spirit, yet all things come from it, because he is good. About that time, there was a codification of the four elements that had been indexing, especially Greek thought, as a harbinger of the Western perspective, air, fire, earth, and water. But that they had an inside, and the inside was ratiable. And the inside, as you can see, is a 90 degree tilted square, which makes a diamond. And those who have done or are taking or taking again the learning civilization recognize the nature square of attention and the conscious diamond of insight that together make an 8-part mandala. But the 8th part has a very interesting ratio at the points of the diamond. And one of the most esoteric of all illustrations of this comes from a magical talisman from Ethiopia. The oblate pairs are not only the ratioing of the elements that are indexed by the points of the diamond of consciousness, but if one looks with just the right look, they also form hearts, four hearts that meet together at a fifth face. That fifth face has the gauge that one's perception sees through the phenomenal, sees through the mental, sees to the spiritual, which has no indexing by space-time, but rather now is another dimension that has like exfoliated itself out of the fifth quintessential dimension of consciousness. And because it has blossomed out, it means that it is not integral, it's not coming in, but it's going out. And so that is described by the word differential. And as differential consciousness, because the field itself is able to blossom further, a sixth dimension of a spiritual person becomes a prismatic form for the first time, becomes not only possible, but searchable. And in order to do so, one has to search in a very special way. One has to search by seeing through written language, seeing through into vision. Because only by that portal and accessing a vision do we come to a 21st century new aeon capacity to understand, first of all, reflectively back 2,000 years, and back 2,000 years before that, and 2,000 years before that, making it very much like a famous quote from Goethe. He said, a man is not civilized until he's lived 6,000 years. That it takes three giant steps to be where we are. And those giant steps are 2,000-year time forms that have other time forms working within them, and that they overlap two different kinds of waves. One, an establishing wave that becomes the anchor. The other is the carrier wave that is the ship that can weigh anchor and go elsewhere and drop that anchor down wherever it has gone and still have the referential wave active, but in a new carrier wave ship combination. And that the pilot waves are all the men and women who are able to man that ship, raise that anchor, find a new port, and put that anchor down there and be at home still. This is the way in which our population is beginning to look at the star system. And beyond that, even being able for the first time to realize that our star system has a membrane. It has a membrane where the energy of light, the energy of our sun, our star, in its solar wind, and all the particles that it carries with it, slows down as it compresses against the membrane of the star system, because there one begins to have, for the first time, four satellites in two pairs that are at the same time reaching that stellar interface with interstellar energy. The two pioneers, pioneers 10 and 11, that went to Jupiter and then were veered off, and the two Voyagers, one was veered off before Voyager 2 was able to go on and have the encounter with planets never seen up close before beyond Saturn, Uranus, and especially Neptune. And in 1989, it was a joy to be at Caltech. Not right on the campus, but in the convention hall in Pasadena, because there were so many people watching Voyager 2 have its encounter with Neptune for the first time. And when the first telemetry photo of Neptune came in, it was a dazzling sapphire blue that had a deep indigo dark spot, almost like Jupiter's red spot. And there was a gasping hush among the several thousand people that, for the first time together as a community of explorers, we were like Magellan looking at the Pacific Ocean for the first time and absolutely astounded at its Pacificness. Neptune was like that. And at that time was the farthest planet from the sun. Pluto was inside the orbit of Neptune. And then, of course, later that afternoon, the first telemetry photo of the giant moon of Neptune, of Triton. And its surface was not cratered, but was mottled like the skin of a cantaloupe. And there were definitely available volcanic black plumes. In this ultra cold moon, it had syrovolcanic eruptions and energy, so one began to understand the cosmos is extraordinarily real, beyond belief, beyond imagining, but encounterable with extra dimensions of consciousness and with the sixth dimension of the spiritual person. One has a seventh dimension of history as a kaleidoscopic pouring. Myth as a dimensional phase courses like a stream, like a river, through the field of nature. But history is like a grand delta of many mouths of a very large Amazonian type river that is able to carve out incredible islands of possibility. And as history does that, our ability to have an analytic refines itself, and science as an eighth dimension comes into play, so that the diamond of insight with vision, art, history, and science sits beautifully in the square of attention, the frame of natural elements making a mandala, that when it rotates, it can rotate either way. It can rotate chirally in a pair. It can rotate clockwise or counterclockwise. And when it does both, it has a double pinwheel quality to it as one gets used to it. And the first description, accurately, of what this is like was from Philo of Alexandria 2,000 years ago, that one begins to see through the written language into an allegorical ratioing of the world that is here, visible, perceptual, conceptual, into other realm that was invisible before, now becomes palpable in an expanded quality, and that this ratioing gives us something that is very, very, very special. The quality of this eight-part, eight-angled, eight-phase, eight dimensions delivers us, as the ancient Hermetica say, into a ninth, where both work not only together, but they have a synergy, beyond a synergy. They have the capacity to bring forth qualities of spiritual personhood which were not discernible before, or they were not discernible in the terms of expanded dimensions of consciousness. In the 20th century, two of the greatest Hermetic geniuses were Yeats and Jung. I did a whole series one time at the Philosophic Research Society, 13 weeks on Yeats and Jung. And it's interesting because Jung got his Hermetic guidance from a man who had lived about 400 years before him, Paracelsus. And it was Yeats's using the differential conscious field of Paracelsus and his spiritual prismatic person and his historical developments, because out of Paracelsus came for the first time a chemistry that was so superior to alchemy that it changed forever the way in which medicine and art are practiced, because they're very close to each other. And it also provided for the first time. He lived in the early 1500s. He passed away in 1541, mostly in Switzerland and Basel. And Jung stopped being a clinical psychologist when he encountered Paracelsus. Something deep in him was called forth. And what was called forth from him was his original spiritual self that, as a boy, had made a little totem talisman and secretly went to the attic of his parents' house and hid it in one of the rafters of the attic. And then, having grown up, having become adolescent, having become a college student, having become a doctor, famous psychiatrist, he suddenly remembered that it was still there and went to the attic, and there in the dust on that rafter was his little totem. And when he retrieved it, and he writes in Memories, Dreams, and Reflections, all of a sudden he realized that his deep spiritual self was not European, that he felt most affine to Africans, and that he said he had everything he could do not to follow Albert Schweitzer and move to Africa and just be there with his kin. He wrote that when you have analyzed more than 10,000 people for their dreams, all Europeans and descendants have a platform in their subconscious, unconscious, that usually is a primitive, someone African or someone, a native of some place. But when you go to the Africans, when you go to the natives, when you go to the American Indians, when you go to the South American Indians, they don't have that. They have an openness. They do not have a shadow. What casts the shadow is the ego. And the ego is like, if you have astigmatism in your vision, it's astigmatism in the inability to have the quintessential differential conscious field open. It has been curtailed by an imposition from the mind that has held up glasses of various colors, various shapes, through which one then says, well, yes, I'm conscious in this way. One of the great talismans in Ethiopia is this net of Solomon. This is meant to capture those stigmatic, demonic interruptions of openness. And it's called the net of Solomon because when the Queen of Sheba visited Solomon as he was in the midst of perfecting the temple and to put the Ark of the Covenant in the temple finally, he had a mysterious liaison with Makeda, who was the Queen of Sheba, who was richer than Solomon, who was even more literate than Solomon. And she's the author of the Song of Songs. She's the wisdom source that Solomon talks about in Proverbs. And when he met the Queen of Sheba, I mean really met her, the remembrance that as a boy, he was always sensitive to the fact that wisdom was feminine. Wisdom in that way settles in and is able to give birth, is able to engender love. is able to sustain life in further dimensions. Because not only is the zero field of nature fertile, but the infinite field of consciousness is the fertilizer, the intersections of those two fields dwarf the ability for people just to have nets or to have diagrams. And their son, Menelik, when he became 21, went to visit his father and found that his father had squandered almost all of the spiritual synergy with his mother. And so he broke into the temple, into the Holy of Holies, and took the Ark of the Covenant, the original one, back to Ethiopia, and it's there today in Aksum, in this church, and it was in this terrain that 200 years ago the Book of Enoch was found, that had been excised as if it were something really dangerous, because it is, because it chronicles the fact that fallen angels are not only real, but when they mate with the daughters of men, the children of that are giants compared to ordinary men. And the only way in which that can be held, not in check, but in a response to that kind of a challenge, is for men to mature into man. And when man occurs, then the symmetry of feminine settling in and the masculine going forth gives that kind of breathing, breath of life to man. And then it is possible for there to be children of that man as a son of man, and they're well able to deal with giants of any size, any dimension whatsoever. Because then the sons of man are free infinitely and fertile in even a zero field. One of the prize persons in history was Mary Magdalene. And we've talked about her last week as the great poetess, the author of the 42 Odes of Solomon. She also was a tremendous artist. And this was a portrait, one of the portraits found on this is the Holy Grail, the original cup that held the liter or two of wine for the Last Supper, was placed in a screen of gold. And these are portraits from that screen of gold. This is a portrait of the young Jesus. He's about 22 or 23 years old. Who could sketch like this? The aesthetic analytic of this shows it's a technique that was learned from a very sophisticated art education. And the artist was one of the great Greek vase painters named Scopas, who centered everything on one eye at the center, and then everything else was a double spiral, chiral, out from that center. This is St. James, who was beheaded in 44 AD. So this was drawn of him before 44 AD. He left for Spain. His great missionary place is at Compostela de Santiago, the starfield of St. James in northern Spain. This is James, about the time that he became the head of the community in Jerusalem, when the resurrected Jesus had become the Christ and had other things to do. This was his brother John, sketched much later. James was 25 at that time, John was 12. And this is the mature Jesus, sketched during the last few weeks of his Palestine mission, about 36 AD. The portrait of Matthew was old Matthew, so I extracted by vision and art the seed of what Matthew would have looked like when Jesus was close to 45. Matthew himself was about the same age. We're going to take a little break and come back. Let's come back to the early 20th century. The first half was a protean prelude to what we're going through now. At that time, there were just a few men and women who were beginning to, like avant-garde pilot waves, be sensitized. I talked about Yeats and Jung. I talked about how Paracelsus influenced Jung tremendously and began to develop in him the sense that he could explore the field, the historical field, and the prismatic person of Paracelsus as a detective clue, pair of clues, and that's what got him into collecting old alchemical books. I've talked about Yeats and Jung, but it's interesting because Yeats's inspiration was poetic, was a figure, and this is the woodcut sketch of him. He first surfaced in Yeats in towards the end of the First World War. His name was Michael Robarts. And it's interesting to note because when this visionary character began occurring to him, Yeats began to understand that his attraction to an organization called the Golden Dawn, a secret order of hermetic order, of which eventually Yeats was the head, and quite a stern disciplinarian. He threw two men out of the Order of the Golden Dawn who were very powerful, even scary. One was Aleister Crowley, and Yeats said, "Mystery schools are not reform schools." And the other was S.L. MacGregor Mathers, who prized himself at having an inside seat to wisdom, because his beautiful wife, Moina, was the sister of Henri Bergson. And the genius of Bergson was all about the way in which creative evolution is exactly this kind of differential conscious field coming into play, so that time, instead of being countable, measurable, was the French word that Henri used was durée. It was a duration. It was a creative duration. And that you could excerpt something as long as you realized that you were just excerpting it. But time itself, with these extra dimensions, does not chop up. It becomes resonant harmonically, and it can have all kinds of chiral spiralings. but you can't chop it up. One of the beautiful things about Mary Magdalene, in addition to her great portrait art, is her great poetic language. And the 16th Ode of Solomon is interesting to give. This is in the translation of James H. Charlesworth, who is still alive, and whose first book on the Odes of Solomon was published by Oxford in 1973. So he's been doing this a long time. As the occupation of the plowman is the plowshare, and the occupation of the helmsman is the steering of the ship, so also my occupation is the psalm of the Lord by his hymns. My art and my service are in his hymns, because his love has nourished my heart, and his fruits he poured unto my lips. For my love is the Lord, hence I will sing unto him. For I am strengthened by his praises, and I have faith in him. And I will open my mouth, and his spirit will speak through me. The glory of the Lord and his beauty, the work of his hands and the labor of his fingers, for the multitude of his mercies and the strength of his word. For the word of the Lord investigates that which is invisible and perceives his thought. For the eye sees his works and the ear hears his thought. It is he who made the earth broad and placed the waters in the sea. He expanded the heavens and fixed the stars. And he fixed the creation and set it up. Then he rested from his works and created things run according to their courses and work their works. For they can neither cease nor fail. And the hosts are subject to his word. The reservoir of light is the sun, and the reservoir of darkness is the night. For he made the sun for the day, so it will be light. But night brings darkness over the face of the earth, and by their acceptance, one from another, they complete the beauty of God. And there is nothing outside of the Lord, because he was before anything came to be. And the worlds were made by his word, and by the thought of his heart, praise and honor to his name. Hallelujah. She also was a tremendous scientist. In one of the really great books on alchemy by E.J. Holmyard, it first came out in a Penguin paperback in 1957, and I remember reading it at the same time as reading Eric Hoffer's The True Believer and trying to read Jung's Answer to Job, which took me a long time to be able to read. He singles out in here the fact that there was a very great alchemist in the first century in Alexandria. He's talking about an alchemical instrument called the reflux distillation or still. There's a furnace, and set in that furnace with its refining fire is a flask. Cucurbit is the original name of it. Also in Greek, it was called a bikos. And coming out of the bikos is a head that caps the heated vapors coming out of the flask, out of the bikos. The Arabic name for this was al-alembic, out of which we get the English word alembic, but the original, the Greek, included the little side bit that feeds into another flask, and the vapors condense here at the ambics, which is what it really was called, the bikos, the ambics, and then this connects to another flask where is collected that which is distilled. This is what Holmyard writes. The invention of the tri-bikos, the thrice greatest bikos, the trinity triple bikos, the trinity distiller, the thrice greatest distiller, which collects what the refining fire has generated and deposits this into a flask, which then can be utilized. The invention of the tribikos was ascribed to a woman alchemist, Mary the Jewess, traditionally supposed to be Miriam, sister of Moses. Moses lived in the 1300s, contemporary of Ramesses II, and his sister was about that same age. The tribikos was invented in the first century AD in Alexandria. In a work passing under her name, quoted by Zosimos, Zosimos was flourished about 300 AD. He was Egyptian. He was from Panopolis, the city of Pan. And he is one of the sources of a shocking alchemical realization for Jung, because Zosimus said it is necessary for certain alchemical processes to take apart what is there phenomenally in order to transform it. One of the words used for it is putrefaction. It has become putrid before it can be changed. Like a caterpillar goes into the cocoon because it's going to turn into goo. But out of the goo will come the butterfly. The butterfly is the symbol of the psyche in ancient Greek wisdom. What comes out of the cocoon is that beautiful spirit being. In a work quoted by Zosimos, instructions for making a tribikos are given. Three copper or bronze tubes should be made, each a cubit and a half in length. A cubit is 18 inches, the elbow to the fingertips. So a cubit and a half is 27 inches. So this is a sizable piece of equipment. And a thickness of metal rather greater than that of a party cook's frying pan. One end of each tube should be admitted to the size of the neck of the receiver, and the other should be soldered into a copper or bronze still head. The still head should fit closely onto the earthenware vessel containing the matter to be distilled, and the joint should be luted, L-U-T-E-D, that is given a seal, with flour paste Similar luting was to be applied between the delivery spout and the receiver. In later times, a special luting known as philosopher's clay, or clay of wisdom, was highly recommended. According to one recipe, it consists of 2/3 clay free of stones and 1/3 of a minute dried dung and chopped hair. Mary the Jewess is also credited with the invention of the water bath, which is still known in France as the bain-marie, which allows you to have an alternate to the sand bath, which was a dry alchemy, but the water bath is this great reflux distillation, which goes back at least 5,500 years. In archaeology, in the Zagros Mountains of what is today Iran, down the slopes towards Iraq, at site 3,500 years BC, were found the remains of a double pot that had two rims, but the rim of the inner pot was perforated with holes. And when you put the petals of flowers in between the two pots in that channel, and you heated the water inside, it would steam up and go through the two holes, and because the other pot held it, it would go down through the petals, and it was the way in which perfumes were first made in the world. So that Mary Magdalene was making the perfume of the spirit person. And later when we get to the great Mahayana, the earliest Mahayana talks about bodhisattvas perfuming the triple cosmos. Here is a medieval print of Mary the Jewess. She was also called Maria Prophetessa, the female prophet, Mary Magdalene. So she was scientist, she was poet, she was artist, and she was an incredible, amazing woman. It's difficult to find a portrait of hers, but in researching a number of years ago, and especially reading the great Dura Europos and its art by Michael Rostovtsev. Rostovtsev was Russian, and his closest friend was the great founder of sociology, Petram Sorokin. And when Sorokin first got freed, Lenin finally let him go because he was too much a revolutionary to keep, but he was almost too famous to kill, so he got him deported. And they sent him initially to what seemed to be the farthest from any civilization. They sent him to the University of Minnesota from St. Petersburg, where he and Rostovtsev thrived, and they both went on to Harvard to become great professors there. Dura Europos was a city and a fortress on the Euphrates River, near where a part of it started to bend to the west. And from Dura Europos, there was a special caravan track that went through Palmyra into the area of Damascus, very, very ancient. But in 241 AD, it was laid siege to and it was destroyed. But it was destroyed so quickly by troops that only wanted to get the booty that they just collapsed one of the outer walls onto the rooms that were adjacent and had used the wall as the back wall of their buildings, quote, buildings. And so that inner back wall was covered with rubble until a British officer, doing some surveying to position his troops, realized that they could move some of this rubble and use it to build defense walls, and discovered that the art on the back walls was intact. And one of the illustrations that was intact are the Three Marys, done about 240, 230, 220 AD by people who would have been born about at least in the second century. And Mary Magdalene is on the right. Mary the mother is in the center. And Mary, one of the sisters of Jesus, is on the left. I have blown up the Mary Magdalene so that you can get some idea of what she looked like. She was obviously with reddish hair, not red hair so much, but burnished brunette hair, quite tall, and enormously capable. I put together years and years ago, when I gave a series in 1990 on the Hermetica, I put together a collage of Philo and Mary Magdalene and her portrait of the mature Jesus against a early Hermetic flask. Glasswork thrived in Egypt by 3000 BC. And it was in the time of the first century BC that in Tyre and parts of Phoenicia, blowing glass for the first time was perfected, so that one had the ability to have what we would call art glass, and by the shipload, very quickly. When you blow glass, you can really go to town. The central city there was Tyre. Tyre is still there, but hardly a village compared to the city that it was. And this beautiful fresco was rescued archaeologically from Tyre. Here are the four white horses of Apollo's chariot, and here's Hermes with his caduceus with the double chiral wand. The Mercury with his wand and winged shoes, boots, leading on Apollo's chariot. And it is in this vein that we come to understand that in the 20th century, not only were Yeats and Jung Hermetic masters, but we can point to two others as well. One of them was Niels Bohr, that we are going to talk about a little later, who took for his family crest, when he earned it from the Danish royalty, he put the Tai Chi, not the yin-yang symbol, the Tao Te symbol, onto the family crest. The other figure was from New Zealand, and his name was Rutherford. Later on, he was made Lord Rutherford. And this is a copy of his last book, published in 1937, a series of lectures given in November 1936, and its title is A Newer Alchemy. This was right at the end of his life. And I have pasted in the family crest of Lord Rutherford. Here on the right is Hermes Trismegistus, and here on the left is a Maori native from the Nelson area of the South Island of New Zealand, where he grew up as a boy, and with a kiwi bird at the top. And this is the family crest of one of the great scientists of the world, Lord Rutherford was the very first person to ever do a textbook on radioactivity. And it came out in 1904, and it was so popular that he had to come out with a second edition in 1913. But the great edition was the third that came out in 1930. By this time, radiation and radioactive substances was a classic because it set the stage for the 1930s development that led directly to atomic energy, but also put a great female Hermetic master square back into the field of vision. And she is featured in the second chapter of a 2011 book on radioactivity by Marjorie Alley. And her hero is Maria Skłodowska, who was Madame Curie. And we measure radiation in Curies because she was the one who understood first that this is a science, not a magic. It is mysterious science, to be sure, but nevertheless, it is capable of an analytic. And because it is an analytic, one can source it in a field of nature, or it can be sourced in a field of consciousness. And if you source in both fields at the same time, you get the double chiral supersymmetry. And if you think symmetry is powerful, supersymmetry extends itself everywhere that we care to explore. There are books on Ernest Rutherford. There are books on Marie Curie. There are books on Niels Bohr, on Yeats, on Jung. Almost no book has had a portrait of Mary Magdalene. So when my book comes out later this year, Jesus in Alexandria and Mary Magdalene, The Origins of Shared Presence, it will be the first time since the early 2nd century AD that a true portrait of her and her contribution are going to be available. Another aspect is there is so much myth surrounding the three magi. The earliest and about the only article on the three magi by somebody who knew appeared in, it was 1905, the Journal of the American Oriental Society from Yale. And in here is an article by the great A.V. Jackson Williams. His full name was Abraham Valentine Jackson Williams, and he was a Zoroastrian expert. He has great books. And this article, "The Magi in Marco Polo and the Cities in Persia by Which They Came to Worship the Infant Christ." Jackson Williams was a great professor at Columbia. And he lists in the article, and I will make copies of that available in my book. It's just about four or five pages. The Magi were Zoroastrians who came at a time when the original ancient Zarathustra had a renaissance. And in the Renaissance of about 500 BC, he was called Zoroaster, the stargazer. Zarathustra, the ancient Avestan, translates as Zarathustra, good with camels. Means the family had caravan routes, and They had caravan routes before horses were really adequately tamed. And where did those caravan routes go? They went east. Like in Ghostbusters, the question from the Ghostbusters, where do these stairs go? And Bill Murray says, they go up. They went east. And why would they go east? Because the great plains of Central Asia are almost infinite in themselves. But if you follow the Amu Darya River, it goes into one of the fingers that is Afghanistan that juts into the Hindu Kush deep enough so that you come to an ability to go through a couple of passes and drop down into what is today China. And when you drop down into it, you find a pair of caravan routes. The later pair was developed in history as the Silk Road, but the earlier was the Jade Road. The Silk Road goes north of the Gobi Desert at the edge of the mountain range there, but the Jade Road goes at the edge of the great mountain range out of which come streams, two streams, that converge at a caravan stop, which in ancient times was given a special appellation because one of the streams washed down bits of black jade and the other washed down bits of white jade. And it's there that jade first became an extremely valuable trade item because it was very hard to find good jade. And the introduction spurred the Central Asians to tame horses. By the time of Zarathustra, born about 2000 BC, he lived to be 77. At 75, he wrote his gathas in what is today Kabul, because he married the daughter of the king of Kabul and loved the family that was there. It is the ability to take a historical kaleidoscope and to reweave the tapestry of the way in which prismatic persons come out of a field of vision, and by generating a historical fabric, one is able to develop the eighth dimension insight of taking a vision as a theory and developing through the prism of the person the historical developments that will lead you to a refining analytic that will allow you to do the transformation of everything, including transforming the four dimensions of the universe, not just the things in the universe, like minerals and metals, animals and plants, or men, but space-time itself can be transformed. And when it does, a third kind of space occurs that was not even believable before. It's a 10-dimensional hyperspace. That's where spaceships become starships, and they travel wherever they want to go. More next week.